Chapter 69. St. Mark's Square lies at the southernmost tip of Venice's Grand Canal, where the sheltered waterway merges with the open sea. Overlooking this perilous intersection is the austere triangular fortress of Dogana da Mar, the Maritime Customs Office, whose watchtower once guarded Venice against foreign invasion. Nowadays, the tower has been replaced by a massive golden globe and a weather vane depicting the goddess of fortune, whose shifting directions on the breeze serve as a reminder to ocean-bound sailors of the unpredictability of fate. As Maurizio steered the sleek boat toward the end of the canal, the choppy sea opened ominously before them. Robert Langdon had traveled this route many times before, although always in a much larger vaporetto, and he felt uneasy as their limo lurched on the growing swells. To reach the docks at St. Mark's Square, their boat would need to cross an expanse of open lagoon whose waters were congested with hundreds of craft, everything from luxury yachts to tankers to private sailboats to massive cruise liners. It felt as if they were leaving a country road and merging onto an 8-lane superhighway. Sienna seemed equally uncertain as she eyed the towering 10-story cruise liner that was now passing in front of them, only 300 yards off. The ship's decks were crawling with passengers, all packed against the railings, taking photos of St. Mark's Square from the water. In the churning wake of this ship, three others were lined up, awaiting their chance to drive past Venice's best-known landmark. Langdon had heard that in recent years, the number of ships had multiplied so quickly that an endless line of cruises passed all day and all night. At the helm, Maurizio studied the line of oncoming cruise liners and then glanced to his left at a canopied dock not far away.
"I park at Harry's Bar?"
He motioned to the restaurant famous for having invented the Bellini.
"St. Mark's Square is very short walking."
"No, take us all the way," Ferris commanded, pointing across the lagoon toward the docks at St. Mark's Square. Maurizio shrugged good-naturedly.
"Your choice. Hold on."
The engines revved and the limo began cutting through the heavy chop, falling into one of the travel lanes marked by buoys. The passing cruise liners looked like floating apartment buildings, their wakes tossing the other boats like corks. To Langdon's surprise, dozens of gondolas were making this same crossing. Their slender hulls, at nearly 40 feet in length and almost 1,400 pounds, appeared remarkably stable in the rough waters. Each vessel was piloted by a sure-footed gondolier, who stood on a platform on the left side of the stern in his traditional black and white striped shirt, and rowed a single oar attached to the right-hand gunwale. Even in the rough water, it was evident that every gondola listed mysteriously to the left, an oddity that Langdon had learned was caused by the boat's asymmetrical construction. Every gondola's hull was curved to the right, away from the gondolier, to resist the boat's tendency to turn left from the right-sided rowing. Maurizio pointed proudly to one of the gondolas as they powered past it.
"You see the metal design on the front,"
he called over his shoulder, motioning to the elegant ornament protruding from the bow.
"It's the only metal on a gondola, called ferro di prua, the iron of the prow. It is a picture of Venice."
Maurizio explained that the scythe-like decoration that protruded from the bow of every gondola in Venice had a symbolic meaning. The ferro's curved shape represented the Grand Canal. Its six teeth reflected the six sestieri, or districts, of Venice, and its oblong blade was the stylized headpiece of the Venetian Doge. The Doge, Langdon thought, his thoughts returning to the task ahead. Seek the treacherous Doge of Venice, who severed the heads from horses and plucked up the bones of the blind. Langdon raised his gaze to the shoreline ahead, where a small wooded park met the water's edge. Above the trees, silhouetted against a cloudless sky, rose the red brick spire of St. Mark's Bell Tower, atop which a golden archangel Gabriel peered down from a dizzying 300 feet. In a city where high-rises were non-existent as a result of their tendency to sink, the towering Campanile di San Marco served as a navigational beacon to all who ventured into Venice's maze of canals and passageways. A lost traveler with a single glance skyward would see the way back to St. Mark's Square. Langdon still found it hard to believe that this massive tower had collapsed in 1902, leaving an enormous pile of rubble on St. Mark's Square. Remarkably, the lone casualty in the disaster had been a cat. Visitors to Venice could experience the city's inimitable atmosphere in any number of breathtaking locales. And yet Langdon's favorite had always been the Riva degli Schiavoni. The wide stone promenade that sat along the water's edge had been built in the 9th century from dredged silt and ran from the old arsenal all the way to St. Mark's Square. Lined with fine cafes, elegant hotels, and even the home church of Antonio Vivaldi, the Riva began its course at the arsenal, Venice's ancient shipbuilding yards, where the piney scent of boiling tree sap had once filled the air as boat builders smeared hot pitch on their unsound vessels to plug the holes. Allegedly, it had been a visit to these very shipyards that had inspired Dante Alighieri to include rivers of boiling pitch as a torture device in his Inferno. Langdon's gaze moved to the right, tracing the Riva along the waterfront, and coming to rest on the promenade's dramatic ending. Here at the southernmost edge of St. Mark's Square, the vast expanse of pavement met the open sea. During Venice's golden age, this stark precipice had been proudly dubbed the edge of all civilization. Today, the 300-yard-long stretch where St. Mark's Square met the sea was lined, as it always was, with no fewer than 100 black gondolas, which bobbed against their moorings, their scythe-like bow ornaments rising and falling against the white marble buildings of the piazza. Langdon still found it hard to fathom that this tiny city, just twice the size of Central Park in New York, had somehow risen out of the sea to become the largest and richest empire in the West. As Maurizio powered the boat closer, Langdon could see that the main square was absolutely mobbed with people. Napoleon had once referred to St. Mark's Square as the drawing room of Europe, and from the looks of things, this room was hosting a party for far too many guests. The entire piazza looked almost as if it would sink beneath the weight of its admirers. "My God," Sienna whispered, gazing out at the throngs of people. Langdon wasn't sure whether she was saying this out of fear that Zobrist might have chosen such a heavily populated location to release his plague, or because she sensed that Zobrist might actually have had a point in warning about the dangers of overpopulation. Venice hosted a staggering number of tourists every year, an estimated 1/3 of 1% of the world's population. Some 20 million visitors in the year 2000. With the additional billion added to the Earth's population since that year, the city was now groaning under the weight of 3 million more tourists per year. Venice, like the planet itself, had only a finite amount of space, and at some point would no longer be able to import enough food, dispose of enough waste, or find enough beds for all those who wanted to visit it. Ferris stood nearby, his eyes turned not toward the mainland, but out to sea, watching all the incoming ships.
"You okay?"
Sienna asked, eyeing him curiously. Ferris turned abruptly.
"Yeah, fine, just thinking."
He faced front and called up to Maurizio.
"Park as close to St. Mark's as you can."
"No problem."
Their driver gave a wave.
2 minutes.
The limo had now come even with St. Mark's Square, and the Doge's Palace rose majestically to their right, dominating the shoreline. A perfect example of Venetian Gothic architecture, the palace was an exercise in understated elegance. With none of the turrets or spires normally associated with the palaces of France or England, it was conceived as a massive rectangular prism, which provided for the largest possible amount of interior square footage in which to house the Doge's substantial government and support staff. Viewed from the ocean, the palace's massive expanse of white limestone would have been overbearing had the effect not been carefully muted by the addition of porticos, columns, a loggia, and counterfoil perforations. Geometric patterns of pink limestone ran throughout the exterior, reminding Langdon of the Alhambra in Spain. As the boat pulled closer to the moorings, Ferris seemed concerned by a gathering of people in front of the palace. A dense crowd had gathered on a bridge, and all of its members were pointing down a narrow canal that sliced between two large sections of the Doge's palace.
"What are they looking at?"
Ferris demanded, sounding nervous.
"Il Ponte dei Sospiri," Sienna said. "A famous Venetian bridge."
Langdon peered down the cramped waterway, and saw the beautifully carved, enclosed tunnel that arched between the two buildings. The Bridge of Sighs, he thought, recalling one of his favorite boyhood movies, A Little Romance, which was based on the legend that if two young lovers kissed beneath this bridge at sunset, while the bells of St. Mark's were ringing, they would love each other forever. The deeply romantic notion had stayed with Langdon his entire life. Of course, it hadn't hurt that the film also starred an adorable 14-year-old newcomer named Diane Lane, on whom Langdon had immediately developed a boyhood crush. A crush that, admittedly, he had never quite shaken. Years later, Langdon had been horrified to learn that the Bridge of Sighs drew its name not from sighs of passion, but instead from sighs of misery. As it turned out, the enclosed walkway served as the connector between the Doge's palace and the Doge's prison, where the incarcerated languished and died, their groans of anguish echoing out of the grated windows along the narrow canal. Langdon had visited the prison once, and was surprised to learn that the most terrifying cells were not those at water level, which often flooded, but those next door, on the top floor of the palace proper, called piombi, after their lead-tiled roofs, which made them torturously hot in the summer and freezing cold in the winter. The great lover Casanova had once been a prisoner in the Piombi. Charged by the Inquisition with adultery and spying, he had survived 15 months of incarceration, only to escape by beguiling his keeper. "Sta attento!" Maurizio shouted to the pilot of a gondola as their limo slid into the berth the gondola was just vacating. He had found a spot in front of the Hotel Danieli, only 100 yards from St. Mark's Square and the Doge's palace. Maurizio threw a line around a mooring post and leaped ashore as if he were auditioning for a swashbuckling movie. Once he had secured the boat, he turned and extended a hand down into the boat, offering to help his passengers out. "Thanks," Langdon said as the muscular Italian pulled him ashore. Ferris followed, looking vaguely distracted and again glancing out to sea. Sienna was the last to disembark. As the devilishly handsome Maurizio hoisted her ashore, he fixed her with a deep stare that seemed to imply that she'd have a better time if she ditched her two companions and stayed aboard with him. Sienna seemed not to notice.
"Grazie, Maurizio,"
she said absently, her gaze focused on the nearby Doge's palace. Then, without missing a stride, she led Langdon and Ferris into the crowd. Chapter 70. Aptly named after one of history's most famed travelers, the Marco Polo International Airport is located 4 miles north of St. Mark's Square on the waters of the Laguna Veneta. Because of the luxuries of private air travel, Elizabeth Sinski had deplaned only 10 minutes earlier and was already skimming across the lagoon in a futuristic black tender, a Dubois SR-52 Blackbird, which had been sent by the stranger who had phoned earlier.
"The provost."
For Sinski, after being immobilized in the back of the van all day, the open air of the ocean felt invigorating. She turned her face to the salty wind and let her silver hair stream out behind her. Nearly 2 hours had passed since her last injection, and she was finally feeling alert. For the first time since last night, Elizabeth Sinski was herself. Agent Bruder was seated beside her, along with his team of men. None of them said a word. If they had concerns about this unusual rendezvous, they knew their thoughts were irrelevant. The decision was not theirs to make. As the tender raced on, a large island loomed up to them on the right, its shoreline dotted with squat brick buildings and smokestacks. Murano, Elizabeth realized, recognizing the illustrious glass-blowing factories.
"I can't believe I'm back,"
she thought, enduring a sharp pang of sadness.
Full circle.
Years ago, while in med school, she had come to Venice with her fiancé and stopped to visit the Murano Glass Museum. There, her fiancé had spied a beautiful hand-blown mobile and innocently commented that he wanted to hang one just like it someday in their baby's nursery. Overcome with guilt for having kept a painful secret far too long, Elizabeth finally leveled with him about her childhood asthma and the tragic glucocorticoid treatments that had destroyed her reproductive system. Whether it had been her dishonesty or her infertility that turned the young man's heart to stone, Elizabeth would never know. but 1 week later, she left Venice without her engagement ring. Her only memento of the heartbreaking trip had been a lapis lazuli amulet. The rod of Asclepius was a fitting symbol of medicine, bitter medicine in this case, but she had worn it every day since.
My precious amulet, she thought, a parting gift from the man who wanted me to bear his children.
Nowadays, the Venetian islands carried no romance for her at all, their isolated villages sparking thoughts not of love, but of the quarantine colonies that had once been established on them in an effort to curb the Black Death. As the Blackbird tender raced on past Isola San Pietro, Elizabeth realized they were homing in on a massive gray yacht, which seemed to be anchored in a deep channel awaiting their arrival. The gunmetal gray ship looked like something out of the U.S. military's stealth program. The name emblazoned across the back offered no clue as to what kind of ship it might be.
The Mandatium?
The ship loomed larger and larger, and soon Sinsky could see a lone figure on the rear deck, a small, solitary man, deeply tanned, watching them through binoculars. As the tender arrived at the Mandatium's expansive rear docking platform, the man descended the stairs to greet them.
Dr. Sinsky, welcome aboard.
The sun-drenched man politely shook her hand, his palms soft and smooth, hardly the hands of a boatman.
I appreciate your coming. Follow me, please.
As the group ascended several decks, Sinsky caught fleeting glimpses of what looked like busy cubicle farms. This strange ship was actually packed with people, but none were relaxing. They were all working.
Working on what?
As they continued climbing, Sinsky could hear the ship's massive engines power up, churning a deep wake as the yacht began moving again.
Where are we going?
She wondered, alarmed.
I'd like to speak to Dr. Sinsky, alone, the man said to the soldiers, pausing to glance at Sinsky. If that's okay with you.
Elizabeth nodded.
Sir, Bruder said forcefully, I'd like to recommend Dr. Sinsky be examined by your onboard physician. She's had some medical...
I'm fine, Sinsky interjected. Truly. Thank you, though.
The provost eyed Bruder a long moment and then motioned to a table of food and drink being set up on the deck.
Catch your breath. You're going to need it. You'll be going back ashore very shortly.
Without further ado, the provost turned his back on the agent and ushered Sinsky into an elegant stateroom and study, closing the door behind him.
Drink? He asked, motioning to a bar.
She shook her head, still trying to take in her bizarre surroundings.
Who is this man? What does he do here?
Her host was studying her now, his fingers steepled beneath his chin.
Are you aware that my client, Bertrand Zobrist, referred to you as the silver-haired devil?
I have a few choice names for him as well.
The man showed no emotion as he walked over to his desk and pointed down at a large book.
I'd like you to look at this.
Sinsky walked over and eyed the tome.
Dante's Inferno?
She recalled the horrifying images of death that Zobrist had shown her during their encounter at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Zobrist gave this to me 2 weeks ago. There's an inscription.
Sinsky studied the handwritten text on the title page. It was signed by Zobrist. My dear friend, thank you for helping me find the path. The world thanks you, too. Sinsky felt a chill.
What path did you help him find?
I have no idea. Or rather, until a few hours ago, I had no idea.
And now?
Now I've made a rare exception to my protocol, and I've reached out to you.
Sinsky had traveled a long way and was in no mood for a cryptic conversation.
Sir, I don't know who you are, or what the hell you do on this ship, but you owe me an explanation. Tell me why you harbored a man who was being actively pursued by the World Health Organization.
Despite Sinsky's heated tone, the man replied in a measured whisper.
I realize you and I have been working at cross purposes, but I would suggest that we forget the past. The past is the past. The future, I sense, is what demands our immediate attention.
With that, the man produced a tiny red flash drive and inserted it into his computer, motioning for her to sit down. Bertrand Zobrist made this video. He was hoping I would release it for him tomorrow. Before Sinsky could respond, the computer monitor dimmed, and she heard the soft sounds of lapping water. Emerging from the blackness, a scene began to take shape. The interior of a water-filled cavern, like a subterranean pond. Strangely, the water appeared to be illuminated from within, glowing with an odd crimson luminescence. As the lapping continued, the camera tilted downward and descended into the water, focusing in on the cavern's silt-covered floor. Bolted to the floor was a shiny rectangular plaque bearing an inscription, a date, and a name. In this place, on this date, the world was changed forever. The date was tomorrow. The name was Bertrand Zobrist. Elizabeth Sinsky felt herself shudder. "What is this place?" she demanded. "Where is this place?" In response, the provost showed his first bit of emotion, a deep sigh of disappointment and concern. "Dr. Sinsky," he replied, "I was hoping you might know the answer to that same question." 1 mile away on the waterfront walkway of Riva degli Schiavoni, the view out to sea had changed ever so slightly. To anyone looking carefully, an enormous gray yacht had just eased around a spit of land to the east. It was now bearing down on St. Mark's Square.
"The Mandatium,"
FS 2080 realized with a surge of fear. Its gray hull was unmistakable.
"The provost is coming, and time is running out."
Chapter 71. Snaking through heavy crowds on the Riva degli Schiavoni, Langdon, Sienna, and Ferris hugged the water's edge, making their way into St. Mark's Square and arriving at its southernmost border, the edge where the piazza met the sea. Here the throng of tourists was almost impenetrable, creating a claustrophobic crush around Langdon as the multitudes gravitated over to photograph the two massive columns that stood here, framing the square. "The official gateway to the city," Langdon thought ironically, knowing the spot had also been used for public executions until as late as the 18th century. Atop one of the gateway's columns, he could see a bizarre statue of St. Theodore, posing proudly with his slain dragon of legendary repute, which always looked to Langdon much more like a crocodile. Atop the second column stood the ubiquitous symbol of Venice, the winged lion. Throughout the city, the winged lion could be seen with his paw resting proudly on an open book bearing the Latin inscription, "Pax tibi Marce, Evangelista Meus." "May peace be with you, Mark, my evangelist." According to legend, these words were spoken by an angel upon St. Mark's arrival in Venice, along with the prediction that his body would one day rest here. This apocryphal legend was later used by Venetians to justify plundering St. Mark's bones from Alexandria for reburial in St. Mark's Basilica. To this day, the winged lion endures as the city's symbol and is visible at nearly every turn. Langdon motioned to his right, past the columns, across St. Mark's Square. "If we get separated, meet at the front door of the basilica." The others agreed and quickly began skirting the edges of the crowd and following the western wall of the Doge's palace into the square. Despite the laws forbidding feeding them, the celebrated pigeons of Venice appeared to be alive and well, some pecking about at the feet of the crowds and others swooping into the outdoor cafes to pillage unprotected bread baskets and torment the tuxedoed waiters. This grand piazza, unlike most in Europe, was shaped not in the form of a square, but rather in that of the letter L. The shorter leg, known as the Piazzetta, connected the ocean to St. Mark's Basilica. Up ahead, the square took a 90-degree left turn into its larger leg, which ran from the basilica toward the Museo Correr. Strangely, rather than being rectilinear, the square was an irregular trapezoid, narrowing substantially at one end. This funhouse-type illusion made the piazza look far longer than it was, an effect that was accentuated by the grid of tiles whose patterns outlined the original stalls of 15th-century street merchants. As Langdon continued on toward the elbow of the square, he could see, directly ahead in the distance, the shimmering blue glass dial of the St. Mark's clock tower, the same astronomical clock through which James Bond had thrown a villain in the film Moonraker. It was not until this moment, as he entered the sheltered square, that Langdon could fully appreciate this city's most unique offering. Sound. With virtually no cars or motorized vehicles of any kind, Venice enjoyed a blissful absence of the usual civic traffic, subways, and sirens, leaving sonic space for the distinctly unmechanical tapestry of human voices, cooing pigeons, and lilting violins serenading patrons at the outdoor cafes. Venice sounded like no other metropolitan center in the world. As the late afternoon sun streamed into St. Mark's from the west, casting long shadows across the tiled square, Langdon glanced up at the towering spire of the Campanile, which rose high over the square and dominated the ancient Venetian skyline. The upper loggia of the tower was packed with hundreds of people. Even the mere thought of being up there made him shiver, and he put his head back down and continued through the sea of humanity. Sienna could easily have kept up with Langdon, but Ferris was lagging behind, and Sienna had decided to split the difference in order to keep both men in sight. Now, however, as the distance between them grew more pronounced, she looked back impatiently. Ferris pointed to his chest, indicating he was winded, and motioned for her to go on ahead. Sienna complied, moving quickly after Langdon and losing sight of Ferris. Yet as she wove her way through the crowd, a nagging feeling held her back. The strange suspicion that Ferris was lagging behind intentionally, as if he were trying to put distance between them. Having learned long ago to trust her instincts, Sienna ducked into an alcove and looked out from the shadows, scanning the crowd behind her and looking for Ferris.
Where did he go?
It was as if he were no longer even trying to follow them. Sienna studied the faces in the crowd, and finally she saw him. To her surprise, Ferris had stopped and was crouched low, typing into his phone.
The same phone he told me had a dead battery.
A visceral fear gripped her, and again she knew she should trust it.
He lied to me on the train.
As Sienna watched him, she tried to imagine what he was doing. Secretly texting someone? Researching behind her back? Trying to solve the mystery of Zobrist's poem before Langdon and Sienna could do so? Whatever his rationale, he had blatantly lied to her.
I can't trust him.
Sienna wondered if she should storm over and confront him, but she quickly decided to slip back into the crowd before he spotted her. She headed again toward the basilica, searching for Langdon.
I've got to warn him not to reveal anything else to Ferris.
She was only 50 yards from the basilica when she felt a strong hand tugging on her sweater from behind. She spun around and found herself face to face with Ferris. The man with the rash was panting heavily, clearly having dashed through the mob to catch up with her. There was a frantic quality about him that Sienna hadn't seen before.
Sorry, he said, barely able to breathe. I got lost in the crowd.
The instant Sienna looked in his eyes, she knew.
He's hiding something.
When Langdon arrived in front of St. Mark's Basilica, he was surprised to discover that his two companions were no longer behind him. Also of surprise to Langdon was the absence of a line of tourists waiting to enter the church. Then again, Langdon realized, this was late afternoon in Venice, the hour when most tourists, their energy flagging from heavy lunches of pasta and wine, decided to stroll the piazzas or sip coffee rather than trying to absorb any more history. Assuming that Sienna and Ferris would be arriving at any moment, Langdon turned his eyes to the entrance of the basilica before him. Sometimes accused of offering an embarrassing surfeit of ingress, the building's lower facade was almost entirely taken up by a phalanx of 5 recessed entrances, whose clustered columns, vaulted archways, and gaping bronze doors arguably made the building, if nothing else, eminently welcoming. One of Europe's finest specimens of Byzantine architecture, St. Mark's had a decidedly soft and whimsical appearance. In contrast to the austere gray towers of Notre Dame or Chartres, St. Mark's seemed imposing and yet, somehow, far more down to earth. Wider than it was tall, The church was topped by five bulging, whitewashed domes that exuded an airy, almost festive appearance, causing more than a few of the guidebooks to compare St. Mark's to a meringue-topped wedding cake. High atop the central peak of the church, a slender statue of St. Mark gazed down into the square that bore his name. His feet rested atop a crested arch that was painted midnight blue and dotted with golden stars. Against this colorful backdrop, the golden winged lion of Venice stood as the shimmering mascot of the city. It was beneath the golden lion, however, that St. Mark's displayed one of its most famous treasures, four mammoth copper stallions, which at the moment were glinting in the afternoon sun. The horses of St. Mark's. Poised as if prepared to leap down at any moment into the square, these four priceless stallions, like so many treasures here in Venice, had been pillaged from Constantinople during the Crusades. Another similarly looted work of art was on display beneath the horses at the southwest corner of the church, a purple porphyry carving known as the Tetrarch. The statue was well known for its missing foot, broken off while it was being plundered from Constantinople in the 13th century. Miraculously, in the 1960s, the foot was unearthed in Istanbul. Venice petitioned for the missing piece of statue, but the Turkish authorities replied with a simple message. You stole the statue, we're keeping our foot.
Mister, you buy?
A woman's voice said, drawing Langdon's gaze downward. A heavy-set gypsy woman was holding up a tall pole on which hung a collection of Venetian masks. Most were in the popular volto intero style, the stylized, full-faced, white masks often worn by women during Carnevale. Her collection also contained some playful, half-faced Colombina masks, a few triangle-chinned bautas, and a strapless moretta. Despite her colorful offerings, though, it was a single grayish-black mask at the top of the pole that seized Langdon's attention, its menacing dead eyes seeming to stare directly down at him over a long, beaked nose. The plague doctor. Langdon averted his eyes, needing no reminder of what he was doing here in Venice.
You buy?
The gypsy repeated. Langdon smiled weakly and shook his head.
Sono molto belle, ma no, grazie.
As the woman departed, Langdon's gaze followed the ominous plague mask as it bobbed above the crowd. He sighed heavily and raised his eyes back to the four copper stallions on the second floor balcony. In a flash, it hit him. Langdon felt a sudden rush of elements crashing together. Horses of St. Mark's, Venetian masks, and pillaged treasures from Constantinople. My God, he whispered. That's it. Chapter 72. Robert Langdon was transfixed. The horses of St. Mark's. These four magnificent horses, with their regal necks and bold collars, had sparked in Langdon a sudden and unexpected memory, one he now realized held the explanation of a critical element of the mysterious poem printed on Dante's death mask. Langdon had once attended a celebrity wedding reception at New Hampshire's historic Runnymede Farm, home to Kentucky Derby winner Dancer's Image. As part of the lavish entertainment, the guests were treated to a performance by the prominent equine theatrical troupe Behind the Mask, a stunning spectacle in which riders performed in dazzling Venetian costumes with their faces hidden behind volto intero masks. The troop's jet-black Frisian mounts were the largest horses Langdon had ever seen. Colossal in stature, these stunning animals thundered across the field in a blur of rippling muscles, feathered hooves, and three-foot manes flowing wildly behind their long, graceful necks. The beauty of these creatures left such an impression on Langdon that upon returning home, he researched them online, discovering the breed had once been a favorite of medieval kings for use as war horses, and had been brought back from the brink of extinction in recent years. Originally known as Equus robustus, the breed's modern name, Frisian, was a tribute to their homeland of Friesland, the Dutch province that was the birthplace of the brilliant graphic artist M.C. Escher. As it turned out, the powerful bodies of the early Frisian horses had inspired the robust aesthetic of the horses of St. Mark's in Venice. According to the website, the horses of St. Mark's were so beautiful that they had become history's most frequently stolen pieces of art. Langdon had always believed that this dubious honor belonged to the Ghent altarpiece and paid a quick visit to the ARCA website to confirm his theory. The Association for Research into Crimes Against Art offered no definitive ranking, but they did offer a concise history of the sculpture's troubled life as a target of pillage and plunder. The four copper horses had been cast in the 4th century by an unknown Greek sculptor on the island of Chios, where they remained until Theodosius II whisked them off to Constantinople for display at the Hippodrome. Then, during the Fourth Crusade, when Venetian forces sacked Constantinople, the ruling doge demanded the four precious statues be transported via ship all the way back to Venice, a nearly impossible feat because of their size and weight. The horses arrived in Venice in 1254 and were installed in front of the facade of St. Mark's Cathedral. More than half a millennium later, in 1797, Napoleon conquered Venice and took the horses for himself. They were transported to Paris and prominently displayed atop the Arc de Triomphe. Finally, in 1815, following Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo and his exile, the horses were winched down from the Arc de Triomphe and shipped on a barge back to Venice, where they were reinstalled on the front balcony of St. Mark's Basilica. Although Langdon had been fairly familiar with the history of the horses, the Arca site contained a passage that startled him. The decorative collars were added to the horses' necks in 1204 by the Venetians to conceal where the heads had been severed to facilitate their transportation by ship from Constantinople to Venice. The Doge ordered the heads cut off the horses of St. Mark's? It seemed unthinkable to Langdon.
Robert?
Sienna's voice was calling. Langdon emerged from his thoughts, turning to see Sienna pushing her way through the crowd with Ferris close at her side.
The horse is in the poem, Langdon shouted excitedly. I figured it out.
What?
Sienna looked confused. We're looking for a treacherous doge who severed the heads from horses.
Yes?
The poem isn't referring to live horses.
Langdon pointed high on the facade of St. Mark's, where a shaft of bright sun was illuminating the four copper statues.
It's referring to those horses.
Chapter 73. On board the Mendacium, Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky's hands were trembling. She watched the video in the provost's study, and although she had seen some terrifying things in her life, this inexplicable movie that Bertrand Zobrist had made before his suicide left her feeling as cold as death. On the screen before her, the shadow of a beaked face wavered, projected on the dripping wall of an underground cavern. The silhouette continued speaking, proudly describing his masterpiece, the creation called Inferno, which would save the world by culling the population.
God save us, Sinsky thought. We must, she said, her voice quavering. We must find that underground location. It may not be too late.
Keep watching, the provost replied. It gets stranger. Suddenly the shadow of the mask grew larger on the wet wall, looming hugely before her, until a figure stepped suddenly into the frame.
Holy shit.
Sinsky was staring at a fully outfitted plague doctor, complete with the black cloak and chilling beaked mask. The plague doctor was walking directly toward the camera, his mask filling the entire screen to terrifying effect.
The darkest places in hell, he whispered, are reserved for those who maintain their neutrality in times of moral crisis.
Sinsky felt goosebumps on her neck. It was the same quotation that Zobrist had left for her at the airline counter when she had eluded him in New York a year ago.
I know, the plague doctor continued, that there are those who call me monster.
He paused, and Sinsky sensed his words were directed at her.
I know there are those who think me a heartless beast who hides behind a mask.
He paused again, stepping closer still to the camera.
But I am not faceless. nor am I heartless.
With that, Zobrist pulled off his mask and lowered the hood of his cloak, his face laid bare. Sinsky stiffened, staring into the familiar green eyes she had last seen in the darkness of the CFR. His eyes in the video had the same passion and fire, but there was something else in them now. The wild zeal of a madman.
My name is Bertrand Zobrist, he said, staring into the camera. And this is my face, unveiled and naked for the world to see. As for my soul, if I could hold aloft my flaming heart, as did Dante's Lord for his beloved Beatrice, you would see I am overflowing with love, the deepest kind of love, for all of you, and, above all, for one of you.
Zobrist stepped closer still, gazing deep into the camera and speaking softly as if to a lover.
My love, he whispered, my precious love, you are my beatitude, my destroyer of all vices, my endorser of all virtue, my salvation. You are the one who lay naked at my side and unwittingly helped me across the abyss, giving me the strength to do what I now have done.
Sinsky listened with repulsion.
My love,
Zobrist continued in a doleful whisper that echoed in the ghostly subterranean cavern in which he spoke.
You are my inspiration and my guide, my Virgil and my Beatrice all in one, and this masterpiece is as much yours as it is mine. If you and I, as star-crossed lovers, never touch again, I shall find my peace in knowing that I have left the future in your gentle hands. My work below is done. And now the hour has come for me to climb again to the world above and re-behold the stars.
Zobrist stopped talking, and the word stars echoed a moment in the cavern. Then, very calmly, Zobrist reached out and touched the camera, ending his transmission. The screen went black. The underground location, the provost said, turning off the monitor. We don't recognize it. Do you?
Sinsky shook her head. I've never seen anything like it.
She thought of Robert Langdon, wondering if he had made any more headway in deciphering Zobrist's clues. If it's of any help, the provost said, I believe I know who Zobrist's lover is. He paused. An individual codenamed FS-2080. Sinsky jumped up.
FS-2080?
She stared at the provost in shock. The provost looked equally startled. That means something to you? Sinsky gave an incredulous nod.
It most certainly does.
Sinsky's heart was pounding. FS-2080. While she didn't know the identity of the individual, she certainly knew what the code name stood for. The WHO had been monitoring similar code names for years.
The transhumanist movement, she said. Are you familiar with it?
The provost shook his head.
In the simplest terms,
Sinsky explained,
transhumanism is a philosophy stating that humans should use all available technologies to engineer our own species to make it stronger. Survival of the fittest.
The provost shrugged as if unmoved.
Generally speaking, she continued, the transhumanist movement is made up of responsible individuals, ethically accountable scientists, futurists, visionaries. But as in many movements, there exists a small but militant faction that believes the movement is not moving fast enough. They are apocalyptic thinkers who believe the end is coming and that someone needs to take drastic action to save the future of the species.
And I'm guessing, the provost said, that Bertrand Zobrist was one of these people?
Absolutely, Sinsky said. A leader of the movement. In addition to being highly intelligent, he was enormously charismatic and penned doomsday articles that spawned an entire cult of zealots for transhumanism. Today, many of his fanatical disciples use these code names,
all of which take a similar form. Two letters and a four-digit number. For example, DG 2064, PA 2105, or the one you just mentioned.
FS 2080. Sinsky nodded.
That could only be a transhumanist code name.
Do the numbers and letters have meaning? Sinsky motioned to his computer.
Pull up your browser. I'll show you.
The provost looked uncertain, but went to his computer and launched a search engine.
Search for FM 2030,
Sinsky said, settling in behind him. The provost typed FM 2030, and thousands of web pages appeared.
Click any of them, Sinsky said.
The provost clicked the top hit, which returned a Wikipedia page showing a picture of a handsome Iranian man, Feridun M. Esfandiari, whom it described as an author, philosopher, futurist, and forefather of the transhumanist movement. Born in 1930, he was credited with introducing transhumanist philosophy to the multitudes. As well as presciently predicting in vitro fertilization, genetic engineering, and the globalization of civilization. According to Wikipedia, Esfandiari's boldest claim was that new technologies would enable him to live to be 100 years old, a rarity for his generation. As a display of his confidence in future technology, Feridun M. Esfandiari changed his name to FM 2030, a code name created by combining his first and middle initials along with the year in which he would turn 100. Sadly, he succumbed to pancreatic cancer at age 70 and never reached his goal. But in honor of his memory, zealous transhumanist followers still paid tribute to FM 2030 by adopting his naming technique. When the provost finished reading, he stood up and walked to the window, staring blankly out at the ocean for a long moment.
So, he finally whispered, as if thinking aloud. Bertrand Zobrist's lover, this FS 2080, is obviously one of these transhumanists.
Without a doubt, Sinsky replied. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly who this FS 2080 is, but
that was my point, the provost interrupted, still staring out to sea. I do know. I know exactly who it is. Chapter 74. The air itself seems fashioned of gold. Robert Langdon had visited many magnificent cathedrals in his life, but the ambience of St. Mark's Chiesa d'Oro always struck him as truly singular. For centuries it had been claimed that simply breathing the air of St. Mark's would make you a richer person. The statement was intended to be understood not only metaphorically, but also literally. With an interior veneer consisting of several million ancient gold tiles, many of the dust particles hovering in the air were said to be actual flecks of gold. This suspended gold dust, combined with the bright sunlight that streamed through the large western window, made for a vibrant atmosphere that helped the faithful attain both spiritual wealth and, provided they inhaled deeply, a more worldly enrichment in the form of gilding their lungs. At this hour, the low sun piercing the west window spread out over Langdon's head like a broad, gleaming fan or an awning of radiant silk. Langdon could not help but draw an awestruck breath, and he sensed Sienna and Ferris do the same beside him.
Which way?
Sienna whispered. Langdon motioned toward a set of ascending stairs. The museum section of the church was on the upper level and contained an extensive exhibit devoted to the horses of St. Mark's, which Langdon believed would quickly reveal the identity of the mysterious Doge who had severed the animals' heads. As they climbed the stairs, he could see that Ferris was struggling again with his breathing, and Sienna caught Langdon's eye, which she had been trying to do for several minutes now. Her expression was cautionary, as she nodded discreetly toward Ferris and mouthed something Langdon couldn't understand. Before he could ask her for clarification, though, Ferris glanced back, a split second too late, for Sienna had already averted her eyes and was staring directly at Ferris.
You okay, Doctor?
She asked innocently. Ferris nodded and climbed faster. The talented actress, Langdon thought. But what was she trying to tell me? When they reached the second tier, they could see the entire basilica spread out beneath them. The sanctuary had been constructed in the form of a Greek cross, far more square in appearance than the elongated rectangles of St. Peter's or Notre Dame. With a shorter distance from narthex to altar, St. Mark's exuded a robust, sturdy quality, as well as a feeling of greater accessibility. Not to appear too accessible, however, the church's altar resided behind a columned screen topped by an imposing crucifix. It was sheltered by an elegant ciborium and boasted one of the most valuable altarpieces in the world, the famed Pala d'Oro. An expansive backdrop of gilded silver, this golden cloth was a fabric only in the sense that it was a fused tapestry of previous works, primarily Byzantine enamel, all interwoven into a single Gothic frame. Adorned with some 1,300 pearls, 400 garnets, 300 sapphires, as well as emeralds, amethysts, and rubies, the Pala d'Oro was considered, along with the horses of St. Mark's, to be one of the finest treasures in Venice. Architecturally speaking, the word basilica defined any Eastern Byzantine-style church erected in Europe or the West. Being a replica of Justinian's Basilica of the Holy Apostles in Constantinople, St. Mark's was so Eastern in style that guidebooks often suggested it as a viable alternative to visiting Turkish mosques, many of which were Byzantine cathedrals that had been turned into Muslim houses of worship. While Langdon would never consider St. Mark's a stand-in for the spectacular mosques of Turkey, he did have to admit that one's passion for Byzantine art could be satisfied with a visit to the secret suite of rooms just off the right transept in this church, in which was hidden the so-called Treasure of St. Mark, a glittering collection of 283 precious icons, jewels, and chalices acquired during the looting of Constantinople. Langdon was pleased to find the basilica relatively quiet this afternoon. There were still throngs of people, but at least there was room to maneuver. Weaving in and out of various groups, Langdon guided Ferris and Sienna toward the west window, where visitors could step outside and see the horses on the balcony. Despite Langdon's confidence in their ability to identify the doge in question, he remained concerned about the step they'd have to take after that, locating the doge himself. His tomb? His statue? This would probably require some form of assistance, considering the hundreds of statues housed in the church proper, the lower crypt, and the domed tombs along the church's north arm. Langdon spotted a young female docent giving a tour, and he politely interrupted her talk. "Excuse me," he said. "Is Ettore Vio here this afternoon?"
"Ettore Vio?"
The woman gave Langdon an odd look.
"Sì, certo, ma..."
She stopped short, her eyes brightening.
"Lei è Roberto Langdon, vero?"
"You're Robert Langdon, aren't you?" Langdon smiled patiently.
"Sì, sono io."
"Is it possible to speak with Ettore?"
"Sì, sì."
The woman motioned for her tour group to wait a moment and hurried off. Langdon and the museum's curator, Ettore Vio, had once appeared together in a short documentary about the basilica, and they had kept in touch ever since. "Ettore wrote the book on this basilica," Langdon explained to Sienna. "Several of them, actually." Sienna still looked strangely unnerved by Ferris, who stayed close while Langdon led the group across the upper register toward the west window, from which the horses could be seen. As they reached the window, the stallion's muscular hindquarters became visible in silhouette against the afternoon sun. Out on the balcony, wandering tourists enjoyed close contact with the horses, as well as a spectacular panorama of St. Mark's Square.
"There they are,"
Sienna exclaimed, moving toward the door that led to the balcony. "Not exactly," Langdon said. "The horses we see on the balcony are actually just replicas. The real horses of St. Mark's are kept inside for safety and preservation." Langdon guided Sienna and Ferris along a corridor toward a well-lit alcove, where an identical grouping of four stallions appeared to be trotting toward them out of a backdrop of brick archways. Langdon motioned admiringly to the statues. "Here are the originals." Every time Langdon saw these horses up close, he couldn't help but marvel at the texture and detail of their musculature. only intensifying the dramatic appearance of their rippling skin, was the sumptuous golden-green verdigris that entirely covered their surface. For Langdon, seeing these four stallions, perfectly maintained despite their tumultuous past, was always a reminder of the importance of preserving great art.
"Their collars," Sienna said, motioning to the decorative breast collars around their necks. "You said those were added? To cover the seam?"
Langdon had told Sienna and Ferris about the strange, severed head detail he had read about on the ARCA website. "Apparently, yes," Langdon said, moving toward an informational placard posted nearby.
"Roberto!" a friendly voice bellowed behind them. "You insult me!"
Langdon turned to see Ettore Vio, a jovial-looking, white-haired man in a blue suit, with eyeglasses on a chain around his neck, pushing his way through the crowd.
"You dare to come to my Venice and not call me?"
Langdon smiled and shook the man's hand. "I like to surprise you, Ettore. You look good. These are my friends, Dr. Brooks and Dr. Ferris." Ettore greeted them and then stood back, appraising Langdon.
"Traveling with doctors? Are you sick? And your clothing? Are you turning Italian?"
"Neither," Langdon said, chuckling. "I've come for some information on the horses." Ettore looked intrigued.
"There is something the famous professor does not already know?"
Langdon laughed. "I need to learn about the severing of these horses' heads for transport during the Crusades." Ettore Vio looked as if Langdon had just inquired about the Queen's hemorrhoids.
"Heavens, Robert," he whispered. "We don't speak of that. If you want to see severed heads, I can show you the famed decapitated Carmagnola, or..."
"Ettore, I need to know which Venetian doge cut off these heads."
"It never happened," Ettore countered defensively. "I've heard the tales, of course, but historically there is little to suggest that any doge committed..."
"Ettore, please humor me," Langdon said. "According to the tale, which doge was it?" Ettore put on his glasses and eyed Langdon.
"Well, according to the tale, our beloved horses were transported by Venice's most clever and deceitful doge."
"Deceitful?"
"Yes, the doge who tricked everyone into the Crusades."
He eyed Langdon expectantly.
"The doge who took state money to sail to Egypt, but redirected his troops and sacked Constantinople instead."
"Sounds like treachery," Langdon mused. "And what was his name?" Ettore frowned.
"Robert, I thought you were a student of world history."
"Yes, but the world is large and history is long. I could use some help."
"Very well, then. A final clue."
Langdon was going to protest, but he sensed that he'd be wasting his breath.
"Your doge lived for nearly a century," Ettore said. "A miracle in his day. Superstition attributed his longevity to his brave act of rescuing the bones of St. Lucia from Constantinople and bringing them back to Venice. St. Lucia lost her eyes to..."
"He plucked up the bones of the blind,"
Sienna blurted, glancing at Langdon, who had just had the same thought. Ettore gave Sienna an odd look.
"In a manner of speaking, I suppose."
Ferris looked suddenly wan, as if he had not yet caught his breath from the long walk across the plaza and the climb up the stairs.
"I should add," Ettore said, "that the doge loved St. Lucia so much because the doge himself was blind. At the age of 90, he stood out in this very square, unable to see a thing, and preached the crusade."
"I know who it is," Langdon said.
"Well, I should hope so," Ettore replied with a smile.
Because his eidetic memory was better suited to images rather than uncontextualized ideas, Langdon's revelation had arrived in the form of a piece of artwork, a famous illustration by Gustave Doré, depicting a wizened, blind doge, arms raised high overhead, as he incited a gathered crowd to join the crusade. The name of Doré's illustration was clear in his mind: Dandolo, Preaching the Crusade.
"Enrico Dandolo," Langdon declared. "The doge who lived forever." "Finalmente," Ettore said. "I fear your mind has aged, my friend."
"Along with the rest of me. Is he buried here?"
"Dandolo?"
Ettore shook his head.
"No, not here."
"Where?"
Sienna demanded.
"At the doge's palace?"
Ettore took off his glasses, thinking a moment.
Give me a moment. There are so many doges, I can't recall.
Before Ettore could finish, a frightened-looking docent came running over and ushered him aside, whispering in his ear. Ettore stiffened, looking alarmed, and immediately hurried over to a railing where he peered down into the sanctuary below. After a moment, he turned back toward Langdon.
I'll be right back, Ettore shouted,
and then hurried off without another word. Puzzled, Langdon went over to the railing and peered over.
What's going on down there?
At first, he saw nothing at all, just tourists milling around. After a moment, though, he realized that many of the visitors were staring in the same direction, toward the main entrance, through which an imposing group of black-clad soldiers had just entered the church and was fanning out across the narthex, blocking all the exits.
The soldiers in black.
Langdon felt his hands tighten on the railing.
Robert!
Sienna called out behind him. Langdon remained fixated on the soldiers.
How did they find us?
Robert!
She called more urgently.
Something's wrong. Help me.
Langdon turned from the railing, puzzled by her cries for help.
Where did she go?
An instant later, his eyes found both Sienna and Ferris. On the floor, in front of the horses of St. Mark's, Sienna was kneeling over Dr. Ferris, who had collapsed in convulsions, clutching his chest.